You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. Radio here on the one and only home of All Marine Radio, the All Warrior Radio Network. Hope you're having a good morning wherever you is. Yep. The you know, I was reminded today as I kind of perused the news, probably started yesterday afternoon, why I hate Donald Rumsfeld so much. What's the difference between using the word hate and loathe? Nancy Pelosi speaking right now. I think she'll get asked by the sympathetic media that adores her why she fucked around with this coronavirus relief package and put all that bullshit in the House version of the bill. Think she'll get taken to task for that? Think she'll get called out of touch? Why are you so fucking tone deaf, Nancy? The same shit that you idiots tried to do and got it, you know, broken off across the bridge of your nose in 2009? You're attempting again? Probably not, right? Think she'll get asked about why her daughter was applauding when Rand Paul said he had coronavirus? Think she'll get taken to task for that? Pretty amazing. You can do that, and nobody says shit. You talk about the version of the Emperor's New Clothes? You know, all you got to do is turn on a TV that's carrying that shit. Loathe. Feel intense dislike or disgust for. All right. Now, what does it say for hate? Hate. Feel intense or passionate dislike for someone. Joe has no respect for the program. Mm-hmm. And you wonder why Joe's hiding under the bed all the time. Because he does shit like that. So, to loathe is to feel intense dislike or disgust for. That's loathing. Hate is to feel intense or passionate dislike for. So I think hate is beyond loathe by definition. Okay. So as of course, as you watch the coronavirus news unfold on a daily basis, you know, one of the things that you can't help but see is The Colleen, sir, what are you doing here?
I had to get my notebook.
Oh, she had to get her notebook. All right. Excuse me. Family business. We're homeschooling, okay? We're really not homeschooling, but. So you're watching the coronavirus thing unfold and everything that goes with it, right? You're seeing interviews with doctors and nurses and whatnot. And they're telling you what they're experiencing, right? And then reporters immediately go back and, you know, and say, hey, there's not, you know, there's not, there's not masks in these hospitals. There's not gowns. God, you know, in Seattle, they put out a call. Can you help us make this stuff? And people that sew. And they did. Right. And, you know, you see versions of that all over the country. You see the governor of the state of New York go on. And he says, you know, it's we need these many ventilators. You see the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio. And he hasn't not, in my opinion, acquitted himself very well as a leader in all of this. His penchant to play partisan politics nonsense in a crisis, I think, marginalized him very quickly. But anyway, so you're watching all of this, right? And let me link it to Don Rumsfeld. Can you imagine? So I'd been out of the Marine Corps for 10 years. I come back in. And, you know, the 1st Division, who I went to Iraq with in 2004, in February 2004, I was on the advance party with Dave Furness. We go over there, and, you know, we're getting our shit together, you know, to relieve the 82nd Airborne. So we're doing our relief in place stuff, right? And, you know, it's very businesslike. And so we relieve them, and then lo and behold, all hell breaks loose. As Marines, probably twice for every battalion that the Army had, Marine battalion, you know, maybe another 30% bigger than an Army battalion. And so there's Marines everywhere. And places that the Army didn't go, you know, Marines went. And it started out there. And all hell breaks loose. And so fighting continues to escalate and escalate and escalate and escalate. Now I've never been to war, right? I'm taking it all in, and I'm watching. You know, General Mattis is the division commander, General Kelly, who I know, right? He's the assistant division commander, and I sit in briefs. I watch this thing, you know, blow up on a daily basis. I have friends. Paul Kennedy's across the river in at a place called Hurricane Point with 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines. and so I'm watching, right? And even to somebody who didn't have a whole lot of experience, it was obvious. We didn't have enough people there. We did not have enough people there. And so can you imagine, as everybody, you know, concludes that, you sit in Iraq in a chow hall or someplace and you're shoving food in your face and you see Don Rumsfeld's snarky ass on the TV and he's telling everybody that, yeah, you know, those reports are bullshit. It would be like what you see on TV if when it gets brought to the governor, you know, Governor Cuomo says, yeah, you know, that's nonsense. You know, we have everybody we need here. And you're sitting there living in the world that you're living in, and you're watching that asshole say that shit. And the American people can only know what the reporters, you know, what people write about it. And everybody drinks the Kool-Aid. And so it would be akin to right now, you're a hospital worker and you know the reality of what's going on in hospitals, right? In the lag time between, right, the nation mobilizing and pushing stuff to you, every day you're having to make do in some way, shape, or form. Yeah, that's what the United States military did in Iraq for years because of that son of a bitch. And so I don't know why I was reminded of that yesterday. And, you know, you see these people saying that, hey, we need this and we need that. Now you see American industry saying, you know, we're turning on it. But the truth is you cannot turn on a dime and produce that stuff and get it to somebody in 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 14 days. Can't do it. Doesn't work like that. So there better be some intermediate measures. That's why I said somebody's got to find a way to re-sanitize this stuff. That those masks go into a cloth basket, you know, hanging there, one of those white cloth, bags, right, that have the metal kind of holders, and you throw it like your towels at a gym or something like that. You throw your mask in there, and they get put through a sanitizer. That doesn't seem to me hard to do. If you can do that with ultraviolet rays, why can't you do masks with some form of some system that allows you to use them again? So anyway, I digress. But again, so you can imagine, and that shit went on in Iraq forever. You know, Jeff Kenney, who will join me in the next hour, but Jeff Kenney tells the story of, you know, waking up after being blown up in Iraq in 2006, and everybody, you know, I think the commandant comes, and everybody, you know, tells the commandant, we need more guys there, sir. This is in 2006. The shit starts in the beginning of 2004. And Don Rumsfeld lies his ass off. He lies his ass off. And you watch it. And so I came home in December of 2005. In 2004. So then you sit on your couch now. You don't know what's going on, right? You lose all sense of, what's going on over there. And you watch him on TV. And your blood just boils. Your blood just boils because he's playing the Emperor's New Clothes. The thing is, everybody's playing it with him. Yeah, everybody's playing it with him. Where were the general officers that were supposed to stand up and say, hey, man, we don't have enough people over there? Right? And ultimately, what happens? 2006, 2007, 2008, there's a surge, and what happens? The thing tips. Right? And that's what the war plan called for to begin with. And so when I had General Zinni on, and he said, well, Mac, the most frustrating part about all of that was everything that happened was predicted to happen in the war plan. That's why you had to go there heavy and sit on that thing. So that stuff didn't happen. So, that's not too long-winded of an explanation of why I hate, not loathe. Loathe is not nearly as a strong enough statement about why I hate Don Rumsfeld. When we were in our hospital, when we were dealing with it, he said it wasn't happening. He said that we were full of shit. He said, just comments from stray bolters from people, you know. And you know, if you can imagine being involved in that. And then for me going back in 2006, and you're watching the same shit on TV. And you're doing the same shit, playing whack-a-mole in Iraq. I mean, we were still, I remember going back to I'm in Fallujah in 2006. And we're doing things like dropping the train station in Ramadi. Why? Because we haven't had enough guys in Ramadi to cool that place out. And it's been 2 fucking years. Why? Because we're playing the Emperor's New Clothes with Don Rumsfeld. Right? His transformation of war. We don't need large formations. We're going to have small groups of people. Special people. They're going to zoom around and whack people. And that's going to make everybody behave. And then we'll give it to the Iraqis. Didn't work like that. He should be in prison for that. My opinion. You miss it by that much, got to go to jail, Don. Sorry about this, but, and it's not going to be a rough, rough jail, but you're not going to be able to write your book and make millions of dollars. Oh, actually, we're going to require that you write a book. Okay. And we're going to proof it, and it better be the truth. And then the advance you get on your book, right, that's going to go to all the people that need money. All the people that need money whose lives were impacted by the war because their husband, brother, sister, mother, father were killed. That's where the proceeds from your book are going to go. So, anyway, I want to play for you here in a few minutes after we officially begin the program. Another excerpt from Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailor. Yeah. So, Hornfisher, I gotta track this dude down and get him on the book. I mean, talk about meticulous research. I don't know how many hundreds of interviews he had to do and how he had to compile a chronology of what happened that morning. But the first report that they get that there's a unknown huge task force believed to be American by the United States Navy coming through the San Bernardino Straits, moving east to west in the San Bernardino Straits. Now, when you get to the west end, and if you hang a right, that's the beaches that down in you got to go a ways, but those are the beaches where the landing's happening at Leyte Gulf. Where MacArthur goes ashore, I shall return, all that bullshit. Yeah, that's happening there. Right. Rear Admiral Bull Halsey has taken the Japanese bait. He was supposed to protect the landing. But fuck, that's boring shit, right? So the Japanese dangle carriers to the north outside of his range, so he's got to go get them. And he does. He takes the bait, hook, line, and sinker. They plant the hook straight into, he swallows it, it goes down his esophagus, and it comes to rest someplace around his sternum, and they yank it. And he goes. So there's nobody there. So this Avenger, at like 6:52, sees these ships, and he radios, hey, there is a gigantic group of ships coming, moving east to west in the San Bernardino Straits. And everybody's like, well, what? I mean, who could that be? I mean, that's the Third Fleet? What? And he said, it looks to be Japanese, right? And this admiral, I think by the name of Sprague, who's commanding Taffy 3, he grabs her handset and he says, before he talks, he says, you know, some novice jackass aviator is going to spin everybody with that stupid ass report. So he grabs a handset or somebody, and somebody spits into it. Yeah, right. Go down and take a look. So they drop from about 10,000 feet to about 1,500 feet. And that's when he radios back and he says, I just saw the biggest meatball on the biggest white flag I've ever seen, along with the Pagoda Tower. Those are Japanese warships. It's two battleships, six cruisers, whatever the hell the whole thing is, right? It's gigantic, and they're destroyer escorts. So it's one of the biggest task force that the Japanese Navy puts together in the Second World War. And there's nobody there. There's nobody there. So anyway, I played for you a little bit about Ernest Evans last week. Now, the part I'm going to play for you right now is Evans is at the tail end of Taffy 3, and they're moving away from the Japanese. The Japanese are within 20 miles. That's 2 miles inside of the range that battleships can engage them. Battleships and cruisers with 14, 16, and 18-inch guns can engage them. And when you listen to this, you know, in the interviews that Hornfisher does, they say, we know how this is going to work out. We know how this is going to work out. And it's not going to work out well for us. The question is, will they destroy everything? Will they destroy the destroyers first because they will screen? Will they then destroy the six escort carriers, jeep carriers, as they're known? And then whatever else exists around it. But you can't run from them because other than the destroyers, none of those can outrun the battleships. And the cruisers are too fast. And the escort carrier can't do it. So Sprague is thinking to himself, I'm going to become notorious for getting all this wiped out. So anyway, the first part of the story is under the command of Evans, the USS Johnston is in the rear. He turns and he lets it rip. And in the segment I played last week, they talked about, you know, their gunnery and how good they were was not an accident. They got good practicing at Roy Namur and in Weetalk doing, you know, gun support there. And if you missed that last week, you should listen to it because it's motivating. If you do a lot of driving, I would tell you, buy this book. Okay. Listen to this book. It's called The Last Stand of the Tin Can Sailor. And you have to listen to it. I listen to it while I work out. I listen to it when I'm in the shower, I listen to it. And I don't drive very much right now. So, I mean, I would listen to it while I'm driving because you got to be able to pay attention to it. Okay. So anyway, Evans turns the Johnston around and without any orders, they get given the spot report. It's confirmed. Evans says, bring it about 180 degrees. Like, what? Well, again, and he said when it was commissioned, this is going to be a fighting ship. And if that bothers you, you need to get off this crew right now. And, you know, you hear a number of guys say, he said it, and now we're doing it. And so he comes about. And, you know, he calls down to the engine room and he said, hey, I need everything that you have down there because we're going to close with these guys. We're going to make a torpedo run and a gun run. So and we're going to do what damage we can to slow these guys down. That's his job, right? That's his job. That was the job of the Johnston that in extremis, they would sacrifice themselves so that the larger, you know, naval vessels, the carriers with more sailors on them, could be spared. And he doesn't flinch from it. He turns that ship straight around. And the first ship they take, they shoot like 40 rounds of 5-inch gun ammunition into the bridge. And they blow the shit out of it. Yeah, that's if you can imagine, if you look at the artwork, if you do a search on USS Johnston, and then put in Evan's name, and then click on images, you'll see artwork pop up, and a lot of the artwork is the Johnston closing, still intact, closing, and what they would do is they chased the splashes of five of the rounds that were being shot, knowing that, you know, the probability that somebody hit the same place twice is small, right? So that's how. So they're closing, you know, smoke billowing out of their twin stacks. You know, the Johnston gonna do battle. They then launch a spread of all their torpedoes, and I can't remember. It might be, I don't know, it might be 6, it might be 8, it might be 10. They blow the front, they blow the bow off one of the cruisers. So this is the second ship they crippled in a matter of minutes. And so they continue, and they're shooting. And Bob Huggins is up in the gun director, and all the guns are slewed to him, and he's just it's like a 1944 version of a video game, except it's real. But all the guns are slewed to him, and he's picking out targets, and the Johnston's doing what it can, the damage that it can. Eventually, it gets hit, and then it gets hit again, and then it gets hit again. And so, I mean, when you hear the Horn Fisher describe it, I mean, it's awful. It's absolutely awful. I mean, the deaths that those guys died when steam lines ruptured, steam lines with boilers going, you know, 100%. You know, and all of a sudden that water that's at 900 degrees, you know, explodes into the boiler room, right, and kills everybody. And so, I mean, they describe what happened. And then the damage control guys that did what they were trained to do, which is put on asbestos suits and firefighting suits and go down there and try to, you know, restore power, try to restore electrical power, right, to the ship, and so that they could turn the screws, right? So anyway, so the Johnston now turns around. And they're only able to make 17 knots heading south. They were going like 34 knots closing. Now they're only able to head south. Now there's, you know, there's dead sailors on the deck. You know, there's dead sailors in the wardroom where they're being treated by the ship's doctor and the pharmacist mate. Right. They're trying to restore power. Can't do it. And again, the ship's rudder's being manually turned by teams of sailors that you can get two guys on the helm, and they're manually turning the rudder. And they take 15-minute shifts, and then the next two guys hop on because they're gassed. So now it's making its way back towards Taffy 3. The escort carriers are now under fire from the Japanese, and the Japanese use colors in their shells so when they hit their water, they can identify which shell is there. So if they're shooting, you know, masses of fire, I know what color I am. So anyway, they're talking about seeing water, colored water splash up around ships. When the Sprague orders all the destroyers to form up and attack. Okay? And they do. And so the Johnson's limping back at 17 knots, and they're closing with the Japanese. Between the and this is the whole and I'll give you the names of the other ships. The Samuel Roberts is part of this group, and there's, I think, one other destroyer. And so they see the Johnston, and the Johnston's fucked up, right? It's got holes in it. You know, the mast and the bridge are blown up. You know, shit's hanging everywhere. They see bodies on the deck, right? And what does Johnston do? He turns his ship around a second time. And so I just want to play a few minutes of that, and we'll do that after we officially open the show. And, I mean, you know, talk about take your breath away courage. You know, just amazing. Just amazing. So, yeah, the last stand of the Tin Can Sailors. If you're looking for inspiration, go ahead and check that out. Thursday morning, Tim Lynch and Jeff Kenny join me here in about 37 minutes. Yeah, in about 37 minutes. So, good morning to you. Dedicated to doctors and nurses around the country that are doing the Lord's work, man. Good luck to you. Just be thankful that you have so many advocates in your time of need. People that take your story to the right people and get you the stuff that you need. Because not all of us got that.
You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore, so young folks, you ignore what I just said.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
All right, time to check the weather. Cloudy and 51 in Quantico. It is partly sunny and 56 at Camp Lejeune. It is sunny and 49 in 29 Palms. Partly sunny and 50 at Pendleton. Dark cloudy 66 at Camp Smith in Hawaii. Dark cloudy 71 at Camp Butler in Okinawa. At Leatherneck. I don't know. Do they call it Leatherneck anymore? I don't even know. Clear dark at 64 in Afghanistan and in Al Asad, big base in western Iraq. Sun setting, cloudy, and 74. The home of All Marine Radio, it is 55 degrees under fair skies. Looking for a high of only 61 today, 65 tomorrow, and then 65 on Saturday. Shithole weather. Sergeant Major from North Carolina. Currently 50 with a high of 62 and a low of 52 overnight. 67% humidity. So at least we got that going for us. He's got one of those apps that says funny shit. Funny profane shit. So he sends me the screenshot. And it says this, it's overcast and shitty outside. Anyway, we'll take a break. We'll check news headlines, and we're going to spend a few minutes with the USS Johnston, the USS Hole, and the USS Roberts on October 23rd, 1994, as they fought for their lives and the lives of the sailors. Taffy 3. So don't touch that dial, promise you. It's unbelievable stuff. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner's looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
I'm good, but I have a story and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All right, now, I mentioned that I wanted to take you with me, right, off the where am I? Alright, so you're on the western side of the Philippines. Alright, if you got a map in front of you, you're off of the western side of Samar. Okay, hence the battle gets its name. When I look at maps, all right, it's 25 October. The White House is following this, right? The White House follows communications. And when they fire the Brown Star Cluster, right, somebody in the White House communication room sees that and takes it in, and they inform the president. He, FDR, monitoring the battle. Okay? So, anyway, so on the morning of October 25th, 1994, what you see is what I described to you earlier, and that is the Johnston has already turned back and already attacked two of the cruisers, blown the bow off of one, so it's essentially dead in the water the ship fights to save itself. It's destroyed the conning tower and the bridge of another one with 40 rounds of 5-inch gunfire. Then it got blasted, so it's now limping back. And so it sees the whole, the Samuel Roberts, and what's the other one? I can't remember the other one, but they're heading, as the destroyers have been ordered to now conduct their attack and to try to slow down this Japanese task force. Okay. So, the hole is in the lead. The senior officer is on the hole, and the Johnston is with it, and they're moving, and they see the Johnston coming the other way. Right. And they go big eyes like, wow, what? And then, you know, you hear earlier before the point you're going to join this, you know, guys are saying like, well, I guess maybe today's the day, right? Maybe I don't live through the day. I'm certainly going to go swimming, but maybe I don't live through the day. And they see, then they see the Johnston, and then the Johnston comes about and joins them, and it's limping along at 17 knots. The closing rate with both forces, the Japanese hauling ass, you know, to the southwest, and these destroyers hauling ass to the northeast, southeast and northwest, okay? So is 50 knots. They're closing at each other at 50 knots. Okay, so I want you to listen to this. What happened? Something didn't happen. It's supposed to.
Three after turrets joined in now, bucking the ship with their stiff report. The destroyer plunged ahead, fishtailing through shell splashes as the decks rattled from the exertions of her power plant. They haven't hit us yet, Lieutenant Dix thought as the hole closed to torpedo launching range. We're almost there. We're all together now. Let's make it good. It all happened in the space of 100 seconds, the events coming too fast for even the most meticulous quartermaster to record in his log. At 7:25 a.m., the hole's impossible luck ran out. Leon Kentberger had been chasing salvos in a desperate bid to keep the hole alive. Battleships and cruisers had the ship's range, and so the splashes were not hard to find. The closer the ship got, however, the more futile the concept of dodging salvos became. It was mostly a pretense in any event, for no ship could actually dodge a high-velocity inbound shell. The first one that hit them was small in caliber, small at least relative to the 14, 16, and 18-inch battleship rounds that were splitting the air with palpable roars, and at the end of their 20-mile trajectories, losing their grip on the sky and falling downward like tumbling trash cans. This one came in fast and unseen, striking the bridge high on the port side. Lieutenant Dix thought, "Oh, Jesus, this is it!" The ship rocked and staggered. There was a flash and a crump, and a whistling hail of metal that killed most of the men in the wheelhouse immediately. Lieutenant Earl Nason, Quartermaster Herbert Dubrava, Fire Controlman Marcelino DiLello, and Soundman Otto Kompunen were gone in an instant. A surreal cloud of green-dyed mist settled over the carnage. Sitting in the pilot house lookout's chair, overlooking Gun 52, Seaman First Class Keith McKay felt a rush of wind around his left calf, looked down, and saw the shrapnel had shredded his dungarees. Blood was running down into his shoe, so he tied a red bandana around his ankle. He looked down at the water sloshing around the deck of the bridge and saw that it ran not green, but red. The reassuring rumble and grind of Bill Sanders's rotating Mark 37 gun director stopped, leaving only ominous silence from the shattered battle station above. The blast spattered the hole's passageways with the remains of breakfast. Pork and beans and cinnamon rolls flew out of the galley and littered the decks. The cloud of vaporized green dye dispersed and seemed to drift down the length of the ship as the hole pressed ahead. Some men who saw it wondered what new horror the Japanese now unleashed. Cries of, "Gas! Gas!" could be heard from panicked crew. Thrown from his chair at the helm, Clarence Hood regained consciousness on the starboard side of the pilot house and saw that Lieutenant Dix had taken over the wheel. Commander Thomas and Captain Kentberger were both hurt, but their injuries were minor. Hood's were too, so he took back his post. Miles to the north, Admiral Kurita saw an American ship erupt in smoke and flame, probably the hole, and the Yamato's log recorded, "Cruiser observed blowing up and sinking at 0725. With the fire control radar gone, control of the hole's guns fell to the CIC team, led by Lieutenants Green and Creamer. They were able to take ranges with the much less finely tuned surface search radar. The two officers focused on lining up the torpedo attack and relaying range and bearing information to the guns. As the ship groped its way toward the oncoming fleet, Hoyt White, a radar man in the CIC, called out ranges and bearings of the Japanese cruisers to the gunners over the sound-powered phones. 13,000 yards, 12,500 yards. The men winced at every vibration and rattle as the shells struck near the ship. Seeing the destruction with one's own eyes evoked one kind of fear. Not being able to see it was perhaps worse. The men in the CIC, or the radio shack, or the engine room, or the gun mounts, or in any of the ship's other enclosed spaces, were spared the horrid beauty of the red, green, yellow, and blue waterspouts rising around the ship. Hoyt White felt the hole reel and shudder, absorbing the blows. There was no telling how serious any particular hit was, or where the next one would strike. From time to time, he found himself staring at the bulkhead that stood between him and the humid, smoky air, and wondering when a round might burst through it, bearing his name. As the three small ships pressed through the squalls on their run against the Japanese heavy ships, the staggering hole in the lead, followed by the Heerman and the Samuel B. Roberts, a sight greeted them unlike any they had seen before, a smoking, gray-black wreck of metal, crawling south as they charged north. It was the Johnston. Limping along on one engine, with no hydraulic steering, the ship was a ruin. And yet, somehow, Captain Evans was pulling her through, returning to formation. Though the destroyer remained on a fairly even keel, the battering she had taken was all too evident. The mast had toppled down around the superstructure. The metal shields and bulkheads around the bridge and stacks were blackened, torn, riddled, and dented, like a coffee can on a backyard tree stump. How a ship in that condition could still make steam was for its engineers to explain. By any fair measure, the Johnston was entitled to call it a day. Her torpedo tubes were empty. At her hobbled 17-knot speed, she couldn't keep up with the other destroyers on the way in. Sprague's carriers needed her smoke. Everyone on the Johnston's bridge had heard the Admiral's order, directing the small boys to form up and attack. Few, if any, believed it applied to their ship. Surely they weren't expected to turn around and go in again. When Captain Evans saw the hole in the Heerman, with the Samuel B. Roberts lagging behind in column, he arrived at a different view of his obligation. As long as his ship had guns that worked, the Cherokee figured he could do something in a fight. He told his dumbstruck men on the bridge, "We'll go in with the destroyers and provide fire support." Evans ordered Ed DeGardy to bring the Johnston around astern the Roberts and informed his officers of the plan. Owing to steering difficulties, the destroyer made a complete circle before steadying on course. The Johnston fell in line with the three other ships, plying the shell-torn waters between them and the Japanese fleet. "Oh, dear Lord, I'm in for a swim," Bob Hagen said to himself.
Can you imagine? All right, can you imagine? So, again, as I listen to it, and Hornfisher, you can see the detail that he writes in, right? All the interviews that he must have done with survivors. And the graphic picture that he paints, from the time that they begin the battle, right? I mean, they're less than, 30 minutes from the sighting of the Japanese ship until this point. Less than 30 minutes into it. And I want to say, his narrative has gone on for 3 hours. And it'll go on for another two and a half or three, I think. So, anyway, if you're looking for something good to listen to, to me, wow. Just talk about inspiration, selfless devotion to something greater than yourself. And the outcome is not only not assured, but the outcome is probably not going to be in your favor. And when I say not in your favor, I mean, probably death. And what do you do? How do you conduct yourself? And as typical of warriors, I think, in general, and certainly of American warriors, their sense of humor, their devotion to each other is absolutely unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. So the courage of the men, not just on the Johnston, those crews on the Hull, the Heerman, and the Roberts. I mean, that's the stuff legends are made of. So anyway, it's a good lesson. So if you care to, go ahead and check that out. Let's check some news headlines. The Associated Press is reporting that China says it's temporarily barring most foreigners from entering as it seeks to curb imported virus cases, which, according to the Chinese, and God only knows if you can believe them, I don't, that an uptake, right, an uptick in coronavirus cases after they, quote unquote, had it under control is because of foreigners. Yeah. Why am I struggling with that? Yeah, because I'm allergic to the whole don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining event. top headlines today relative to the DOD is at the top of the fold in Stars and Stripes. Pentagon halts all overseas travel, increases restriction on bases as coronavirus cases reaches 600. AP says, hang on to your cash, pay with plastic. The Army and Air Force Exchange Service is asking customers to pay with credit and debit cards, not cash, as they seek to protect their employees from the transmission of coronavirus. A Yokosuka-based sailor, and you're talking about onesies and twosies, right? Onesies and twosies. Let's see. No kisses, no hugs. With shore leave canceled, homecoming looks different for Yokosuka sailors and their families. U.S. forces in Korea confirm another coronavirus case on Camp Humphreys for a total of 11. So bad in the news. Also in Afghanistan, Afghan government and Taliban say prisoner release to start within days. Now, again, that was originally negotiated by the United States, saying that the Afghan government would release 5,000. The Taliban would release 1,000. And so the Afghan government quickly balked. They renegotiated it. So from Kabul, thousands of prisoners in Afghanistan could start being released early next week, fulfilling a key condition of a nearly month-old U.S. Taliban deal to bring peace to the country, according to government and Taliban officials. The two sides agreed on the prisoner release Wednesday, days after Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the U.S. would cut $1 billion in aid to Afghanistan after he wasn't able, during a lightning visit to Kabul, to resolve an impasse between President Ashraf Ghani and his political rival Abdullah Abdullah over who won the last presidential election. The rift between the two men has been blamed for stalling the peace process by delaying the naming of a government delegation to hold talks with the Taliban, another key condition of the February 29th deal. But yesterday, the government published the names of its delegates to the inter-Afghan talks with the Taliban. Shortly before that, the Taliban and the government said they'd reached a compromise on prisoner release, which was supposed to start more than 2 weeks ago after holding a four-hour video conference facilitated by Washington, D.C. The government agreed to release 100 Taliban prisoners at the end of March, the National Security Council said in a statement released after the video conference. Details of further releases would be announced in the coming days. Wow. 100. The U.S. Taliban deal called for 5,000 Taliban and up to 1,000 detainees held by the Taliban to be released by March 10th. But both the inmate releases and the talks between the government and insurgents are behind schedule. Ghani, 2 weeks ago, proposed a phased release of inmates who would have their biometric details recorded and sign a guarantee not to return to combat. Yeah, that might happen. But the Taliban rejected that offer, insisting 5,000 of their fighters must be released at once. The Taliban and the government representatives are expected to hold face-to-face talks in the coming days. Let me just tell you, if the government in Afghanistan does that, they're dumber than a bag of hammers. At some point, right, somebody's got to say, this is crazy. So, again, news out of Afghanistan, which isn't breaking squelch these days because the air is sucked out of the room by the world dealing with the coronavirus. Marine Corps time stories. Oh, hold on. Let me do the top five stories. Well, let me do this. Tim and Jeff will stand by. So, COVID-19 cases continue to rise. The military could throttle how much information it releases. The Iraqi military, two rockets hit Baghdad's green zone. So, evidently, the boys are up to no good again. But doesn't say that they fell in vicinity of anything close to the United States. So, we'll stand by for more information. And the top five stories in Early Bird today are as follows. Number one, U.S. military suspends all travel to COVID-19 among troops. Jumps almost 60% this week. Number three, defense lawmakers shift to paper hearings to keep military budget process moving. Number four, a headquarters Marine is the first service member to contract COVID-19 in the Pentagon. A Marine assigned to the service headquarters office in the Pentagon has tested positive for COVID-19. a Marine Corps spokesman confirmed to Military Times yesterday, becoming the first service member assigned to the Defense Department's home base to contract the coronavirus. Number five, yeah, not too many. I mean, like, okay, somebody contracted it. I guess if that's news, then that's a good thing, right? Number five, latest emergency coronavirus funding packages includes tens of billions for defense and the VA. Let's see. Where is that money headed for? The Defense Department is supposed to get another $10.5 billion in emergency funding, and the Defense Department another $19.6 billion as part of a $2 trillion package designed to blunt the economic impact of the ongoing coronavirus outbreak. The money includes $1.4 billion in direct funding for National Guard deployments to help state governments respond to emerging health needs, $1.5 billion for the expansion of military hospitals and mobile medical centers if needed, $1 billion for the Defense Department to help with production of medical supplies running short because of the pandemic. How about the VA? Veteran Affairs. Within the VA, the majority of the money, nearly $15.9 billion, will be used for direct care specifically in response to veterans' health needs. Quote, this covers treatments of veterans nationwide for coronavirus within VA hospitals, as well as in community urgent care clinics and emergency rooms. So claims by veterans. These funds allow the VA to cover overtime for their clinical staff, the purchase of personal protective equipment, test kits, and other necessary equipment. So nothing extraordinary out of there. So there you have it. We'll take a break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.